Tereo Ererangi o Te Mānia. This episode was produced in Otatahi by Plains Media, with support from New Zealand On Air.
It's time for Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books.
Kia ora, welcome to Bookends with Marianne Stone and Maureen Rutt, and what a triumph Word was.
Unbelievable, so exciting. I actually thought you were going to get our names wrong because you're so exhausted after your Word efforts, Maureen.
No, the brain is still functioning. Other parts of me might not be, but let's not go there. So we've got really a good lineup today. We always have a good lineup. I don't know why I'm saying that, but I'm going to be talking to Stacey Gregg, who is one of my huge favourites in children's and young people's writing. She just goes from strength to strength, and this new book of hers about cats setting off on their last journey is it's delightful.
It's delightful, yeah. Well, a move away from horses as well for Stacey. And I am sticking with the children and young adult authors theme for one of my interviews with Kitty Lightfoot, who has written a beautiful children's book called Te Nahere I Te Pō, and I'm very much looking forward to chatting with her. And I also had the pleasure of talking with Gina Butson about her debut novel, The Stars Are a Million Glittering Worlds, which is fabulous, and is receiving great feedback. So two books that I highly recommend and can't wait to share with everybody.
Stacey Gregg, Ngāti Mahutu, Ngāti Pukeko, Ngāti Maru Hauraki, is one of our best known and internationally best-selling authors of middle-grade fiction. Her novel Nine Girls won the Margaret Mahi Book of the Year in 2024, and after having such success with ponies and a talking tuna, she has turned to cats in her latest book, The Last Journey. I don't think you can fail with felines, Stacey, can you?
Well, I personally, who doesn't love a cat? I mean, I just can't see how cats could possibly fail, and particularly not these cats.
No, they are. Well, you represent the full gamut of the type of cat there is out there. But Puskin, the leader of this gang of cats, actually has his origins in your very own cat.
Yeah, I mean, my actual cat is called Puskin, which either speaks to my enormous lack of imagination or the fact that he's just such a compelling character. And in fact, my editor said, can't we give him a name that's a little bit more, you know, in keeping with the fact that he's going to be the cat that will lead these guys to salvation and change the world and will go up against the government? And I'm like, no, I think Puskin's about the right name for a cat like that.
Well, I'm thinking of
Puskin has remained.
Yeah, because in the book he's Abyssinian, isn't he?
Mm.
But your cat has an even more exotic lineage.
Yes, well, Puskin in the book is Abyssinian because, of course, the mysticism of Puskin's story is that he descends from the goddess Bastet, the Egyptian cat god, who is, of course, Abyssinian. They were the first cats that were domesticated. And although they sound frightfully exotic, I think in the UK, one in five cats now is Abyssinian in the average household. So they're a common breed. My Puskin is a Burmilla. So he's half Burmese, half chinchilla. And since we already own his cousin, who's a full chinchilla, and Ferris is the most lovely little hang-around-the-house cat, and my Puskin is like out on the streets trying to be a UN ambassador, I think that's the Burmese in him. I'm going to put it down to that.
So the origins
he was
of
definitely the inspiration. Yeah,
well,
that started from.
And the other inspiration was the situation you found yourself in the Auckland floods, where you were homeless, basically, flooded out and everything gone.
It's not an exaggeration. I had just actually finished writing Nine Girls the day of the Auckland floods in January 2023. I had pressed send on my laptop. I had ordered a pizza and opened a bottle of champagne. My agent had the manuscript now in the UK, and I was thrilled with it. And by the time the pizza delivery guy phoned me to say the rain is too heavy in Auckland for me to get the pizza to you, I said, well, there's no point in bringing it. I'm kind of up to my waist in water in my living room now. And the house was completely trashed. We filled 8 jumbo skips with all of our possessions. As bad luck would have it, as misfortune would have it, we'd just cleared out my lockup, which had all my foreign rights editions, and they were all lying on the floor. We're just in the process of building a walk-in wardrobe, so all my clothes were on the floor. So I literally had nothing but the shirt on my back and my pets and the kids, and we moved to a cul-de-sac around the corner. We got super lucky and found a house to rent, and we got even luckier because that cul-de-sac was filled to the brim with cats of all breeds. And that was where the story kind of started, with the idea of, like, going through a trauma and being displaced by world events and cats. So these cats that I was watching out my window, I started to develop this fanciful sort of narrative around their lives, and my Puskin, of course, being the leader, because that's how he is. He's just that guy. He's the cat that other cats will follow.
The interesting thing about this story, well, maybe it's there in a lot of your stories, but it is very linked to world events. It's a very political book, but it's in the guise of a really fantastical journey, and a journey that grips you, whatever age you are, and whatever level you want to read it at.
Yeah, and I think to me that is where all good middle grade fiction should live. You know, that you should be able to read it on multiple levels. I think that was true of Nine Girls.
Definitely.
You know, you can read it simply as it's a hunt for some buried gold with a talking eel, or you can read it as, you know, a history lesson on the Raupatu, the Tainui Land Wars, the Springbok Tour, Bastion Point, Rangiafia, or you can read it on a deeper level of what it is to fight back against politics and governments and power. And certainly with The Last Journey, with Puskin's story, I think it started out in my mind very much as, it wasn't particularly a deep allegorical tale about fascism. I don't think I set out going, right, I'm the next George Orwell. This is Animal Farm Mark II. But those themes just kind of find themselves, I think, in the work. And they always have in all of my work, you know. I think to think of me as the pony book girl who's just written nice books about horses and girls having wonderful adventures together, it completely misunderstands my intention with the work. And I think there are always deeper themes, but certainly with The Last Journey, Puskin's story it's the story of refugees. It's the story of a disenfranchised community being scapegoated. It's a story of standing up for what's right and, you know, finding some sort of resource inside yourself, this level of bravery that the cats find to make this journey. I just love the complexity of this furry band of brothers as they all find themselves, not just Puskin, but all of them find what it is that changes inside of them as they make this journey. In a book that's about pussycats for kids.
Exactly. And all the sort of crazy things they have to do to survive on the way. Some of them have been very pampered. Some of them are far more independent and foragers themselves. And some of them create havoc and pick fights.
But believable, right, Maureen? Did you find the journey believable?
Absolutely. Well, I have a cat called Coco, but she is actually quite different from the Coco in your book. She's a very old cat now, but very cantankerous. But I think she would have chosen not to go on the trip for various reasons. But, yeah, Puskin manages to, well, he's all the time scheming and plotting and planning, isn't he, and working out ways of how to do things. and they've all got to escape from their various households in order to make this journey. They've got to get out and go because there's massive injustice. There's threat of extermination for the older cats. So they really have no choice.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is, I mean, the idea to outline it a bit more clearly is, and it came to me a little bit like, you might be of my vintage and actually remember Logan's Run.
Yes.
The Michael York movie where when you reach the age of 30 in this utopia, you had quite willingly went to be put to death so that you could make way for the next generation. And Logan's Run was kind of in the back of my mind when I was writing this. I loved it so much as a concept carousel and the whole idea of that. And I was thinking about what if these cats encountered an environmental catastrophe and they were the scapegoats for it, and if the birds started dying out and humankind, because they were worried, because the birds, of course, are there to suppress insects, the insects rise up, they eat the crops, there's a worldwide food shortage, and conveniently a fascist government decides to blame cats for the problem, and they start out with, you know, the easy measures that we're even undergoing now of like feral cat culls and ruffs and bell collars and curfews, and then they step it up a notch and up a notch and up a notch, and the cats watch this thinking, how bad can it get? You know, no, we're fine, we're fine, until really it goes full Logan's Run on them. and they realise that if they're going to have to protect the older cats in the community whose time is ticking...
The curiosity is coming for them. Great.
The curiosity.
Great choice of words. Yep.
Yeah, you'll forgive the cheesiness there of the curiosity comes to pick.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
But, I mean, it's a terrifying government agency of men whose sole purpose is cat extermination, and Puskin and his friends know that, well, Puskin knows. Puskin sees it quite clearly because he's been chosen from when he was very young. He's the chosen one. His mother knows this because she has the sight, and he's very lucky there's another cat in the cul-de-sac, Miss Cleopatra, who also is a seer, and she gives him the heads up and says, get out of town.
You've got to go, yeah.
You've got to go.
There's a wonderful... piece of the book where they've managed to get on a train, because humans, of course, are helping them. There is a significant proportion of the populace who are afraid of what's going on and realise that cats are you know at such risk, so they're willing to help the cats make their last journey. So that's a wonderful passage when they're in the train and everybody is conspiring to make sure that they're safe and they get to where they need to go.
It's delightful, isn't it, when you realise that, you know, there is a resistance and
yes.
that humans are not all, that, you know, the evil is not absolute, that there are good people out there and they're willing to take the risk and help these cats and get them to safety. And, of course, they're not going to safety. They're going to a hidden island of lost cats where things are even more dangerous than the curiosity.
Now, that's a really interesting situation too, isn't it? Because these are domesticated cats and they have to kill in order to survive, and that for some of them that has not been an easy, well, when I say not easy, it doesn't necessarily come to them instinctively to them to kill, to survive.
Yeah, and I mean, obviously there are other environmental issues that came through in the book as well as I was working, because, you know, in the UK cats kill 55 million birds a year. Mm. In New Zealand, they kill 100 million birds a year. And so that's, you know, you can see the logic behind feral culls. You can also see the problem behind feral culls, because if you look at exemplars in the past, you know, in Australia when they decided to eradicate all the cats from Macquarie Island, for instance, in the hope that they would help to save the wildlife, instead, once they eliminated the cats, all the rats, the stoats, the rabbits all rose up and decimated the island. So as much as we want to think we can solve a puzzle by cats are bad, cats catch birds, let's get rid of the cats or let's control the cats, it may not be the fix-all that we think it's going to be. And certainly, obviously in the story, cats are not actually the villains, as it turns out, but also the cats themselves struggle with that, with thinking about, are we the baddies here? Like, we're predators. That's how we're wired. And certainly, because the whole book is told from the point of view of Pushkin, he is the narrator, that was one of the most complex things for me, was writing those chapters where the cats have to cross that line and there's no one there to open a can of cat food for them.
No.
They're going to have to fend for themselves, and we have to confront the truth of what that means for cats. That means taking life.
Yep.
And I think for many readers who are adult, that's been the bit that's kind of given them the squeamishes. I don't think it's been a problem for kids. I think kids are much more prosaic, more matter of fact about death than we are.
Yeah, I wondered about that. Yeah, when they finally have to be cats and and fend for themselves, how the kids would react to what are, you know, straightforward descriptions of slaughter and hunting and.
I've definitely put, you know, a bit of velvet over the paw when it comes to how the kills happen. And, you know, I don't think any kid will be in tears about that. There are a couple of things in the book that you will no doubt think kids might be in tears about. And I will say that when I was writing a couple of the later chapters of this book, and I have a really great editorial team at Simon & Schuster in London, and I trust them implicitly, but they made a couple of suggestions that I kind of sat at the kitchen table and sobbed for 3 days before I could write a couple of the scenes.
Heartbreaking.
It's hard going.
It is. Cat Island, you know, is where there's a huge confrontation between them and the feral cats. But you have resolved it all wonderfully, and I'm not breaking any rules by saying that Lottie, the lovely young girl who is Pushkin's, well, she is his owner, but we never own cats. She does come back into the story, so that's a lovely turn in the narrative, I think.
I mean, Pushkin and Lottie have a special bond. You know, it transcends so many things what they go through together, and I'm a terrible helicopter mother with my own Pushkin, and he got stolen about 3 months ago, from our street because he's just such a wanderer, and he.
Yeah.
We got him back because he was microchipped, but then he went missing again about a week ago, and I fly at the whole street. I went up and down and put leaflets in all the mailboxes, and three different houses got back to me on the phone and said, oh, we've got him. He lives at our house now. And I'm like, oh, my God.
Yes.
So he's a hard cat to keep on the porch.
Yeah, clearly.
And I was Pushkin in the story, but, you know, Lottie and I, we share the same burden. Right from experience here.
That's good. Yeah, well, I love the fact that you kept that bond going, that she wasn't just there in the first few chapters and then Pushkin was on his own. So well done. Clearly this is, you know, Simon & Schuster are international publishers. You've set it in Britain. So it's going to have an international audience, and it probably already has. So you are getting feedback.
Yeah, and it's for me, I think, it's the book I'm probably most proud of, and this is book number 39.
Wow.
So it's not like I haven't had others. And, you know, of course, Nine Girls won the Mahi last year, but this is my book. And I'm actually just in the process now of the finishing off the last few chapters of the sort of follow-up, which is tentatively called The Pack. And it focuses on a group of dogs who end up hopelessly lost in the Cairngorm Mountains in Scotland. So there's it's a slightly different journey because I have a very different relationship with my dog than I do with my cat. It's slightly less, the love is more conditional with my dog, let's put it that way.
But clearly you'll be carrying through various political, social, environmental concerns in this book.
Yeah, and I think they turn up without me even looking that hard for them. I think the story is always paramount. You know, I'm always trying to tell a story that is a story that will grip kids and keep them reading. It's not about being preachy. It's not about, you know, making a point. It's more like the points just turn up by themselves. And, you know, if all the kids ever read it as is a whole lot of cats go on the run and end up on a hidden cat island, then fine by me. It's the main thing for me is that they laughed and cried and were there all the way with them, and that's what really matters.
Brilliant. And if they pick up something else, then all to the good.
Absolutely. Let's get kids reading for pleasure. I think. On that note, I mean, I don't know if you've had a chance. Oh, you've probably got the original copy. I can see it there in your hands. You've got a review copy. The actual copy that's for sale in the shops has the most wonderful illustrations throughout the whole thing by Susie Mason. And if anything's going to get kids reading, it's the fact that if they get through a chapter, they get to one of her incredible drawings, and they are just so beautiful. So I'm so thrilled.
Well, that's great. I will go and when I'm next in Scorpio, I will pick a copy up and make sure that I see the illustrations. Thank you, Stacey. You do such a wonderful job of enticing children into your books and parents as well, and for standing up for children's literacy and te reo in books, all the things that you must be exhausting.
No, it's exhilarating, and good. You know, it's the best job in the world. So thank you so much for having me on, Maureen. And nga mihi ki a koe i tō mahi herehere. Thank you.
Kia ora. Stacey Gregg's new book is called The Last Journey, and it's published by Simon and Schuster.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM. Streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
Kitty Lightfoot is an author of children's and young adult books, originally from Irirangi, England, but now living in Tamaki Makaurau. Te Nahere I Te Pō is her third illustrated picture book and her fourth publication, following her celebrated young adult novel Bear, which won Storyline's Tessa Duda Award in 2024. Kitty joins me over Zoom for a bookends chat to discuss her work this morning. Tēnā koe, Kitty.
Tēnā koe.
It's lovely to have you on the show.
Lovely to be here.
Cool. Kitty, Te Nahere I Te Pō is a book filled with love for Aotearoa, but can you remember your first impressions when you arrived from England?
I was actually a baby, so I can't remember. But I love that you call it filled with love, because I do think of it as my love story to New Zealand, to Aotearoa, and how lucky I am to call it home. So I was born in England, but my mother is a Kiwi and my dad is English. And so the plan was always for us to come back to Aotearoa eventually. While I have a Māori name, I proudly hold a Māori name because it was always the plan we'd come here. And so I came before my first birthday, so no memories. So it feels very much like home. In fact, when I returned to England, I thought, maybe I'm really English at heart. Maybe I'm going to be filled with this kind of sense of this is where I belong. And as soon as I got off the plane, I just longed for Aotearoa again and realised this is definitely home.
Fabulous. Thank you. It is a very lyrical book written with real magic in the kōrero, thank you. But it is also a book that owes enormously to its illustrator. So tell us how did you and Pippa Keel Situ, is it Situ, come to collaborate?
What a gift it was to have her illustrate this book. I'm blown away by what she has created. I met Pippa, well, I actually only met her a few weeks ago down in Wellington as part of the book awards for our book Bear, because she illustrated my young adult novel Bear. I really wanted that to have illustrations as well. I think because I love working with illustrators so much, writing picture books, that when it came to writing a novel, I didn't want to miss out on that opportunity to work with someone. So I said, no, it's got to have illustrations as well. So Pippa did a beautiful job for Bear as well. And when I was telling the amazing Jenny Helen at Allen & Unwin about my picture book ideas, she really wanted Pippa to do this one as well. So we got to work with each other again, and yes, I'm blown away with her illustrations. She's just captured the colour palette of the Ngāhere so beautifully, especially at sunset as it's getting darker, and that's the magic that I wanted the story to have. So she, just beautiful, rich tones, the oranges and reds, and then it sort of gets, as we get into the midnight, that but she's got still this amazing colour palette. So, yeah, I'm so thrilled. She is a real talent.
It is very, very beautiful. And it leaves so much room for the lyricism and the music of the words as well, and the music of Te Reo Māori in the words to come through. It's a beautiful, beautiful harmony in the book.
Oh, thank you.
What does it mean for you to be bringing Te Reo into your writing in this way?
Yeah, it's really important to me. And when I say it was a love story to Aotearoa, it's also, for me, a love story with Te Reo Māori, which, you know, I'm still learning. I'm still very much on a learning journey, and I'm learning often through my writing. I'm kind of discovering it and learning as I go. So, but in particular, this book, I just have a new nephew. He's just turned one, but he was very much in my mind when I was writing this. His name is Awanui, and he lives in Rotorua with all my other nieces and nephews down there. And he's in a household that speaks Te Reo Māori. All his brothers and sisters went through Kurukaupapa. And so he was very much in my mind, as well as other tamariki who want to learn Māori. And so I just love, what I really wanted to do was to blend English and Te Reo Māori together in the way that my whānau speak, you know, and I'm Pākehā, but I love to use lots of Māori words, and I really wanted to capture that. And especially in this kind of current environment at the moment, I just think there's so many other families who want to do that too. And the feedback from people who've read it is that that's what they want, and they're buying books like that. And publishers are doing an amazing job of capturing that, what's out there in the market as well. So
indeed they are. They really are capturing that for this moment in Aotearoa. And I want to talk about the New Zealand Children and Young People's Awards with you in just a moment as well. But one thing there that you talk about is that using Te Reo and English together in that way, in your family, and that was certainly a big part of my parenting with my kids as well. Was they were just starting to learn, you know, Te Reo was being spoken more in schools, and so for me, picking up Te Reo was a large part of learning with them and sharing stories with them. So this book does that really beautifully. You can imagine an adult who is less familiar with Te Reo feeling comfortable with this book. And so it's great to hear that that was your intention. Do you want to just say a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so going further, a little further back into my background. So my parents separated when I was quite young, and my father had another child with a Māori woman. So I have a sister who's Māori, Anihira. And so for me, my whole life has been in bilingual households. Her mother was very clear with me at 9 years old, you've got a little baby sister and I'm going to be speaking to her in Te Reo Māori and I really want you to as well. And it's really important to me that she grows up with her reo. And so that has been a big part of my life since I became a big sister. And yes, I think schools are doing just such a magical job of doing that. And I get to spend lots of time in primary schools and now with older books, intermediates and high schools too. And I'm really blown away the job that teachers are doing. And my children are 18, 13 and 9. And I was so proud of them as Pākehā, and my younger two are actually Samoan as well. But how they have learnt and love to learn Te Reo Māori and what it has brought to their lives. And then me as well as their parent kind of watching that and learning alongside. And recently I was down doing a little library tour and there were some kids there come to listen to the story and we played some bird song at the start because there's a ruru in the book. And so I played the little, the nighttime sounds of the ruru and I said, what's that creature? And all of the kids kind of went, it's an owl, it's an owl. And then I read the story and we did a little craft activity where they made a little hand puppet. And when I asked them as they were leaving what they were going to call that, their hand puppets, they all said ruru, all of them. No one had a unique name. They all said ruru. And it was really beautiful in only 25 minutes together that they'd gone from that being the owl to only being referred to as the ruru. And that's how quickly kids absorb. You know, so the language in this book is sort of, you know, like ngāhere for forest and rākau for trees and things. It just took one reading and it was there.
Mm. It's done in a way that integration so that it really flows, especially the early pages give us the interchangeability of reo and English. Then we move into an area where we're just getting the animals' names mostly and then finishing again with that interchange. But it's very skillfully done. I can imagine it being a real learning tool for adults and pepe alike. This year's New Zealand Children and Young People's Awards celebrated the strength of Māori voices in our young people's literature in a way which I hear you doing yourself in your kōrero. Were you ever nervous as a Pākehā author? You've talked a lot about your experience and your deep exposure to our Māori and to multicultural family contexts. But were you ever nervous as a Pākehā author that you could be seen as co-opting? Has that been an anxiety that you've had, or does it just feel completely natural for you?
It did. It was there initially, and I felt like I needed permission almost. I was like, am I allowed to? And so I spoke to my sister about that, and she's always fiercely says, yes, our whakapapa is kind of woven together like a little flax kite together. And so I would never claim Māori whakapapa or want to tell Māori stories. Of course we want those voices to come through, but in terms of speaking Te Reo Māori, I think I have so many discussions with friends and family about the role that Pākehā have in terms of treasuring Te Reo Māori, and that we do have a place, and that to normalise this, and that's the best thing for the language, is for it to be normalised and for us all to share this and to hold it as a taonga, as a treasure for our country. And that really gave me the faith that I needed, that this was an important story, and actually it's really important for me to share this. And of course I need to get all the Māori words checked to make sure I'm doing a good job, and we seek those support people, the amazing translators that are out there, to confirm that I was on the right track. But yeah, it was important for me, and it was that was actually really an amazing kind of experience to think about my why, you know, why is it that I do this, and to tell my story, and and that the heart of it is an absolute honouring of the beautiful language. And it's like when you refer to it as being the musicality of it, that's what I see. I just see that it is such a beautiful language that it had to shine through. I really wanted it to be like a lullaby for Tamariki. Mm. It's a, you know, a huge advocate for reading to children every night before bed, and from a very young age, you know. And I think about, that's why for my nephew, I'm like, I want him to be reading Puka Puka from, you know, a couple of weeks old. Mm. It's his life, and of course, and it is now. And so my dream for this one is that it's the kind of book that is a nighttime little lullaby. And it was inspired after going for a walk in the Waitakere Ranges with a ranger who did a beautiful job of taking these little 7 and 8 year olds through the forest at night. And they were all really scared at the start. And then he just brought to life the magic. And he used a lot of te reo Māori as he was speaking, because of course, you know, I think, and to introduce that idea of kaitiakitanga to young people as, you know, that we are the guardians of our natural resources. And my daughter was with me, and she was, you know, she's a real city kid. We live in Owairaka and Mount Albert in central Auckland. You know, we've lived in this area most of her life. But she loved that experience. But only a few nights later, we heard a ruru in the trees outside, because we are lucky enough to live on a maunga on Mount Albert, and we do get lots of visits from lots of manu. And she heard this ruru calling as she went to bed, and she said, "Oh, Mum, I'm going to have the best night's sleep tonight." And I was like, "Why?" And she goes, "Because I have a ruru, I've got a kaitiaki tonight.
Oh, wow.
I'm going to have the best night's sleep because it's right outside." And that is what the ranger had talked to her about as well. And what a gift it is to have these beautiful birds in our environment. And yeah, but I'd already had the idea.
That is a fabulous bit of background story and magic. And I love that there was a kaitiaki in the Waitakere who took you on the same journey that you take us in the story. This is a return to children's picture book after Bear. So I'm interested, are we expecting another young adult novel from you? Bear was such a huge success. Are you working on something else in that space now?
Yes, I'm on my sort of second, third draft of another, perhaps more of a middle grade. I love that age group that sits somewhere between middle grade and YA. That kind of 10 to 14. I really love writing for that age group as well. And so, yes, I'm working on a novel there. And, similar thing. It's definitely not a sequel to Bear, but it explores... some kind of parallel themes, things I often do write about tricky families and family dynamics, and also has a bit of a kaitiaki in this one, funnily enough. So I've been working away at that and lots of other picture book ideas as well. So yeah, I hope to write for both children and young adults. I really love writing for both. I particularly love going to schools and talking to children and young adults about writing. And yeah, Bear was a phenomenal experience for me. It took me a long time to write that book, about 12 years, because I kind of gave up on myself halfway, thought I'm never going to finish this, or a bit of imposter syndrome going on there in terms of writing a whole novel and feeling a bit inadequate. And then gave myself a bit of a talking to and said, well, in lots of ways, I feel like the character did.
Yes.
The character was like, "Don't give up on me." He was kind of following me around. It was like, "You can't, you know, you've put me in a really tricky chapter right now. Now you've got to get me out of it." So I got on and finished it. But it was, I think, because I hadn't had a novel published, I didn't know if I was sort of wasting my time. I felt like, is this ever going to turn into anything? So having now completed one and have a lot more kind of faith in my abilities, I've been able to finish this other book in a lot, yeah, shorter time frame.
Fabulous. Oh, well, you'll have readers across Aotearoa who are excited for that. But I guess I just want to bring us back to your most recently published, Te Nahere e Te Pō. This is a book that is, I felt, like tucking in the planet every night as a meditation that you might share with your pepe. And so it is beautifully illustrated and it's one to treasure. Te Nahere e Te Pō, published by Alan and Unwin. And thanks so much for joining us to share your story, Kitty. Good luck with all your writing from now on. Kia ora.
Thank you so much. Kia ora.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM, streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
The Stars Are a Million Glittering Worlds is the evocatively named debut novel of Aotearoa Kaituhi, Gina Butson. Gina is a former lawyer turned writer with plenty of previous creative writing competition and publishing credits in her kete, but after the very positive reaction to this novel, she looks set to become a well-recognised name among New Zealand book lovers. Kia ora, Gina joins me from Tamaki Makaurau. Tēnā koe, Gina. It's wonderful to have you on Bookends.
Tēnā koe, and thank you for having me, and thank you for that really generous, lovely introduction.
Well, it is. It is a real pleasure. Gina, the book is actually quite sad, though, isn't it? Would you describe it as a haunted story at its heart?
Yeah, I suppose so. It's interesting, different people's reactions. Somebody said to me yesterday, oh, I thought it was going to be more dark while I was reading it, but it's quite hopeful. And then someone else messaged this morning and said, I liked that there was a real darkness underlying it. So I think people respond to it in different ways. But yeah, haunted's probably quite a good word for it. I haven't heard that used before in relation to it, but it is, yeah, it's a lovely word and it's probably quite accurate.
Cool, because do you want to just tell the listeners the events in your life that gave you the kind of first kernel of sadness that's at the heart of the story?
Yeah, it's probably a bit of a jigsaw puzzle of events in my life that have just been sitting in my subconsciousness for a long time. So a lot of it probably stems from the death of my parents, which was obviously quite a two major events in my life. After Mum died in 2007, I went to Central America, much like the characters in the book, and spent some time just taking a break from everything and travelling around. So I was carrying the grief of her death, but also while I was there, I stayed in a town called San Pedro, again like the characters. And while I was away from the town just briefly, because I went there and came back a few times, one of the people that we'd spent a lot of time with in the town died. And I got back from those travels, and I really wanted to write about my time there. But his death was the story that was just the thing that kept coming up. And yet it didn't feel like my story to write. So I didn't write anything about it at all. And then some almost 20 years later, it came up. A lot of death in this story, but the other story that's always
There sure is.
The other story that's kind of been sitting there the whole time is not too long before Mum died, my parents moved house to a flat section, more accessible. There was a man living next door who he was in his 90s and had lived in the place for years and years and years. And when he died, some people came round to clear out the section, get ready for sale. And there was a garage at the back of the section which had plants growing up all around it and old rusted cars sitting in front. And so my parents, as they did from the kitchen sink, watched all this being cleared away. And then one day Mum called me to say they'd just towed out an orange Datsun, which looked like it was in pretty good condition. And the reason it struck in her mind was that they had an orange Datsun, my parents, back in the 70s, not long before Mona Blades disappeared. And when Mona Blades disappeared, the police were apparently looking for an orange Datsun.
Wow.
And interviewed a whole lot of people. Yeah. And Mum wasn't accusing the man next door. In fact, she had said to me, it's not him, because they solved that case. I don't know if she mentioned Mona Blades by name. But I think it just, we got talking about how cold cases are often solved years later when the person who's been a threat to somebody is no longer a threat. You know, they've died, they've gone to jail or whatever. Yeah. And it just got me thinking about this idea of somebody staying with somebody that they don't trust or that they know has a secret, because there are reasons for that person to stay in the relationship. So yeah, the novel, okay. These things.
That explains so much about the novel. Listeners, that is a fabulous background story, and there's so much more content to milk out of that particular story too, Gina, I'm sure, for your future writing. I guess because in this novel, it isn't the character who is murdered who is our heroine for this story, but you do draw the character who's murdered really, really fully. In fact, it feels unusual to have a strong point of view character for so long in a story who disappears, who then... did you struggle with that as an idea, to write a point of view and then have it just disappear so the rest of the novel has to unfold without it? That felt to me like giving the readers an experience of grief. I just wonder whether that was your intention.
Yeah, I wish it was, because it sounds like a much more intelligent, considered thing to do. But I don't think it was. I think I was just writing through instinct. As I was writing, actually, there were different points of view that I took out. I think I just started writing what I wanted to write. Along the way, I might have had feedback, actually, about people liking her voice and wanting to hear more of it. If I had thought about it, I probably wouldn't have done it that way. It probably would have seemed too wrong. So I'm glad I didn't think about it.
Wow. As a person who struggles, you know, to kind of write myself, that's a really interesting take on things. I'm glad I didn't think about it too much. Love that. So our actual heroine, Thea, she's a remarkable, capable, principled, loving, adventurous woman, and yet it takes such a long time for her to trust herself. How did you determine what was the right amount of grief and guilt to burden her with for us to understand and kind of empathise with how held back she is?
Oh, again, you're going to... I shouldn't answer. I should let you just talk about the book, because you make me sound much better than I am, much more deliberate. I think, again, I wrote this during an MA at the International Institute of Modern Letters, so I had the advantage of a supervisor and other people in my workshop group giving feedback. So I'm sure along the way they would have made comments about, in fact, there were some comments about her taking on too much guilt and it being annoying. So that was helpful because I moderated, you know, some of it. But again, I probably wasn't, I mean, I must have been thinking about it. But yeah, some of it is just coming from my own experience. So I was just writing what I felt was right. But then there was an element of being conscious of, she is, like you say, capable and independent and has her own career and so forth. And that's the balance I wanted to play with, you know, that people aren't all one thing, right? They can be outwardly have it all together, but there's this... weakness or the second guessing of themselves or this Achilles heel or something. So,
yeah, no, well, you achieve that really well. And we do empathise with Thea, regardless of occasionally going, wake up, you know. So also I just wanted to say the climbing story that we begin with is beautifully told. Are you a climber?
I used to be a rock climber for many, many years. So I have done some alpine climbing. Not so much, but that's how my climbing kind of started, was on Ruapehu. And then I moved much more into outdoor and indoor rock climbing. So That's not unfamiliar territory to me. And yet I wouldn't want people to think I was an experienced mountaineer.
No, but the story has a lot of authenticity in the way it's told. It's and it's beautifully rendered. And in fact, that's something that is getting a lot of notice about the book is how well you have done both characters and settings. The book is all its settings are beautiful, including the early climbing settings. Lawrence Fernley summarises your plot device as a journey marked by pain, secrets and guilt to a place of forgiveness, acceptance and peace. Okay. And, I think that's a great summary, but it's kind of a tricky thing to have a novel's whole tension and momentum built around, will my character work out what she's worth? You know, like this, it's a whole novel to answer that question. Is that how you thought about what your plot was?
Not, I don't think so. Again, I wish I had smart things to say about it, but I think a lot I was just writing what felt right and then doing finessing. It wasn't just, sit down and write this thing. But for the ending, for instance, I won't talk about in much detail, but I didn't know what the ending was going to be until I wrote the ending, and I wrote the ending pretty much at the end.
Right.
So it's almost like the story was writing itself to that ending.
Right.
I think at one point it was more of a, not murder mystery as such, but that was a bigger thread. And then I realised it's not so much a murder mystery, it's more a story of a life. So, and a story of a character.
Yeah. Yes, because it is. It's Thea's story about her journey. But it's interesting because you say that, because one of my questions was whether you intended the reader to imagine that there could have been a darker story here. And because all the way through there is that possibility. And we don't actually ever know properly whether that's true. But Thea's movement onwards is regardless of that possibility. Did you mean for that possibility to be something that pulled the reader through the story?
Yeah, 100%. And I think when I was first writing it, that was probably more of a driving force. And now that, that story that kind of inspired the novel in some ways, that was probably always at its core. So the sense of wondering too, and I do like the fact that people still wonder what the actual story was, what did happen, and people do have different views on that. I'm not even sure myself. When I was writing it, I didn't know what the true story was, and it got a bit stressful towards the end of the MA year when I had to hand in my thesis, and I was like, oh, now I need to finish this story. And I had, again, feedback from classmates, which is really helpful, but even then we didn't have a firm view. And that's what I mean about the story. The ending kind of just wrote itself in a way. It resolved itself in a way that worked out. But I like that there's this darkness underneath it and that you have that sense of wondering. A lot of the story I think of as these small decisions that, you make one decision and it changes the course of your life. Even if it's not in a major, dramatic way, but that sense of wondering is of a similar theme to me, the kind of the what ifs.
The title really plays with that, as well as how, as well as beautiful settings that you put your novel into. The title plays with that what ifs. I think there is that Thea's journey is marked by how vulnerable she is to that risk, because of where she's up to in her own story. So the book's really sympathetic to her, but I guess one of the things, why do you think it's so hard for women, even really strong women, to figure out how to trust themselves?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, isn't it? I don't know, there's probably so much that you could answer that question with just the way we've been. I mean, I was brought up to think I could, you know, to believe I could do things. I had parents who never questioned what I wanted to do. I've also had really great bosses who have been the same. They believed in me almost more than I believed in myself, arguably, which is an interesting point, isn't it? So, yeah, I don't know why we had the imposter syndrome, or even as an independent person, I can be quite responsive to somebody else, you know, if they give me that indication that they need me, you kind of want to fulfill that need, right? Even if it's not the best thing to do. So, yeah, I don't know. I don't know the answer, or at least not in a nice, snappy, short.
But grief might have something to do with it, and your own grief might have something to do with with that answer as well. So, thank you very much for sharing that.
And I think certainly, sorry, in Thea's case, it is, you know, what if her parents hadn't died? What would, how would she be different? You know, what if she hadn't gone travelling and met the people that she met? So all these, all these what ifs.
You've had a well-deserved great reception to this book, Gina. In particular, as I've mentioned, the really rich characterisation, that ability to create tension just about somebody's journey. How are you finding having your first novel out there in the world?
Oh, I'm so thrilled with its response, because it's something I've wanted to do my whole life and haven't actively pursued. There were long periods of my life where I didn't write at all, caught up working or climbing or so on. So to finally sit down and done it and have some validation that it was worthwhile and it's worth pursuing, it is a dream come true. And I know there's so many great books that get published that I'm just enjoying it while it lasts, and then I'll sit down and try and do it all again.
Oh, look, that's wonderful. Thank you very much. Listeners, the book is The Stars Are a Million Glittering Worlds by Gina Butson, and it's published by Allen and Unwin.
And join us, Marianne Stone and Maureen Rout, on Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books, next Tuesday on Plains Media.